Have you listened to the Drew Marshall Show before?
George Bush is the Antichrist. Honest to
you
God.
You think George Bush is the Antichrist?
Yes.
Okay, so George Bush is the Antichrist because he's a nice guy.
He's a nice guy. He's fooling people. He's a trickster.
Would you vote for George W. Bush?
Absolutely.
Why? He's the Antichrist.
I think the guy needs to read his Bible.
Would you vote for George W. Bush?
Absolutely. I hope he's not the Antichrist because I'm going to vote for the wrong guy.
Yeah, I hate when that happens.
The Drew Marshall Show, right here on Joy 1250.
You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
I'd gone through so much other stuff that walking down the aisle was tough, but now I know it's not enough.
I want to be a con.
I asked the Lord into my heart, they said that was the way to start, but now you've got to play the part.
I want to be a con.
Be a clone, give conviction good night. Cloniness is next to godliness,
right?
I'm grateful that they showed the way, cause I could never know the way to serve him on my own.
I want to be a con.
Well, many of you will remember Steve Taylor from his I Want to Be a Clone days. And some might remember him for those songs which spoke out against such things as, I don't know, maybe the mindless Christian subculture, Bob Jones University and its anti-interracial dating policy, televangelists like Jimmy Swaggart or Robert Tilden, anyone also who maybe claimed to be a pro-life activist that kind of went around blowing up abortion clinics and killing doctors. It kind of makes your head turn to one side, doesn't it? This guy's worked with countless artists over the years, Sixpence None the Richer, Newsboys, Michael W. Smith, just to name a few. And certainly joining us today on the show is one of my all-time heroes, Steve Taylor. You know, the word iconoclast is used all the time with you, isn't it?
I have heard that a few times, yes.
Where did it come from? I was asked that one time on a Big God TV show up here, one which I was sort of kicked off, and I didn't have an answer. I couldn't figure it out.
I don't know. I grew up in a Christian home. My dad is a pastor.
Oh, that's it there.
Well, I wasn't really a rebellious kid, though, you know, because it's one thing when you hear your dad say one thing and do another during the week, but my parents were very consistent, so I really had nothing to rebel against when I got to be a teenager. I'm not sure where it comes from.
Well, we'll figure it out one of these days after the trumpets blow, I guess. Here's my flashback. Yellow suit. New Wave haircut, Knott's Berry Farm, New Year's Eve, some New Year's Christian fest back when I was 17. That was a wild night, man.
Yeah. It's the mind gets fuzzy. But back then, you know, we all, I guess there's photos of me dressed like that following me around, but my excuse is, you know, a lot of us dressed that way back then.
Yeah. A lot of hair gel in that day.
It was.
I remember a lot of energy. Things like accidentally kicking off the tuning head of a bass while doing a cartwheel kind of energy.
Ah, that's right, man. You got a good memory.
That's funny.
I broke my ankle once jumping off stage at the Cornerstone Festival.
Flat out broke it.
Yeah, the jump was planned, but some kid had snuck under the rope, so I avoid landing on the kid, but I could actually hear it snap when it landed. So, but we still had three songs left, so I just did the rest of the set on one foot.
You invented the Christian pogo.
Yeah, that's very nice to say, and I really hope that that's somewhere on my tombstone or near.
Yeah, that's a thing to hang on to.
That's right.
Put that on your resume. No, but I'm sure places like Hillsong in Australia are very thankful that you invented that. Biola University, California. I got a few Biola connections.
You've done your homework. Yeah, I went to Biola for a year. I actually went on a academic scholarship, and I managed to lose that after the first year, so I went returned home, tail between my legs, to Colorado University in Boulder, and that's where I finished up school.
I lived at a place called Hume Lake Christian Camps up in Kings Canyon.
Of course. Very good.
For a number of years, and we had a lot of Biolites. I don't
right.
know if you call them that or not, but...
Yeah.
John Davidson's summer camp, you were one of 100 chosen from 20,000 hopefuls to spend a month learning from Tony Orlando, Florence Henderson, and John Davidson. That gives me a bit of a chill, actually, hearing that.
Man, this is where I think you did too much homework. Yeah, that's true. I was still trying to figure out kind of what my musical mojo was going to be, and I just sent an application, and I got selected. So you can't really tell John Davidson no, and it went well. One of the things it taught me was how to make for an interesting concert. Hopefully so people wouldn't get bored. And
yeah, that never happened to your concerts, let me tell you.
That's good to know.
Well, I had Tony Orlando on, a few months ago now. I can't remember when it was.
Did you really?
Oh, we had a great chat. I mean, he gave us, about an hour. The stories that comes out of him, his Jackie Gleason story is hilarious.
I've never heard that.
Oh, my goodness. Back in the days of racism before Archie Bunker came on the set, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Oh, unbelievable. Well, because Don, the black girls, and, anyway, there's...
Right.
So many stories came out of him. Did you get much of a chance to learn from Tony Orlando?
We did. We had probably about an hour and a half with Tony, including a Q&A. And, he was very good. He knew what he was doing, very articulate. Had a lot of good stories to tell, a lot of good advice to impart. He was good.
You're known for being one of the most intelligent, energetic, humorous, and outspoken artists in the music scene. Now, kind of looking back with the benefit of a bit of hindsight now, What are the ingredients in your formative years that made you that way? Again, we talked about you grew up in the Jesus family. Your father was a pastor. But there's so much more to you. There's so much. I don't want to sound like I'm sucking up here, but there's so much more depth to you than is rarely seen in the Christian music scene.
Well, I went to Biola for a year, and I took a lot of Bible courses, and I really enjoyed that and appreciated the time. But then I went back to Colorado University in Boulder and finished school there. And at the same time I was doing that, I was actually working as a youth pastor. So, my kids were asking a lot of questions, and at the same time I was being kind of confronted with a very radical campus environment. And so, the kind of stock answers just wouldn't cut it, and I was getting challenged myself. So it forced me to dig deeper into, why I believe Jesus is the Son of God and sort of the rationale for Christian belief. Hmm. And it also struck me that, at least at that time, my generation, we didn't particularly listen to sports figures that much anymore or movie stars. We were listening primarily to music and musicians. And I had some measure of musical gifts. I wasn't a particularly good singer, but I could write music and record it and arrange it and things like that. And so, and around that same time, I heard this band called The Clash. That was an English punk band from England, and I just loved them. They were really great. They were engaged. They wrote great lyrics, and none of them, when they formed, none of them could play their instruments. So I thought, well, this is perfect. I can't really play any instruments, but I got a musical. Some musical ability, so yeah, I'll be like The Clash.
But it was their lyrical content too that kind of hooked into your passion as well.
Yeah,
right?
Well, it was really good because it was they were very politically engaged, and a lot of their politics I didn't agree with, but man, they really knew how to turn a phrase in their lyrics. And Christian music at the time seemed, pretty bland, outside of some notable exceptions like maybe Resurrection Band and some people like that.
Mark Hurd,
yeah, and Larry Norman, of course.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it seemed pretty bland, and it kind of felt like it didn't really have a clue what was going on in the rest of the world. And so it just seemed like a very wide open field. I didn't set out to be in Christian music. I set out to write, kind of punk new wave music that was informed by my Christian worldview. And when I took the songs out to L.A., the pop label said, well, we like your music, but your lyrics would offend our listeners. So I went to the Christian labels, and they said, well, we don't like your music, and your lyrics would offend our listeners. And so that pretty much defined where I've lived the rest of my professional life, is kind of stuck between those two worlds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I resonate with that a fair bit myself. Would you say, Stephen, folks, again, just to remind you, we're on the phone with Steve Taylor. Would you say that the album I Predict 1990 was maybe your most misunderstood work? That people have said that. Is that accurate?
I think that's true. Yeah. The single biggest thing that informed that album, and some of your readers may not even remember this,
The Wittenberg Door.
Well, the Wittenberg Door was a big influence, but it was during this time there were these there were these congressional hearings going on with, I think it was a Marine Colonel Oliver North, and he was, you know, he claimed to be a Christian, and I wouldn't say that he wasn't, but he was giving the reasons why he lied to Congress, and essentially saying it was okay because, you know, I was lying.
The end justified the means. Yeah,
right. The end justifies the means. And not only did that attitude infuriate me, because I don't see how you can be a Christian and believe that the ends justify the means. How you can have your faith put in, you know, God Almighty and think that somehow we know better. But what really infuriated me was how many American Christians were nodding their head and saying, "Oh yeah, that guy's right."
Amen,
you know?
Preacher brother. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't a particularly political album. It was just saying, where did we get off track like this? How did this happen? And it was a fairly angry album, I would say, that was informed by that, as much as anything, that particular kind of state of mind. And that's where songs like "I Blew Up the Clinic Real Good" came from. You know, how can you claim to be pro-life as I am pro-life and believe that a blowing up an abortion clinic is okay?
Yeah.
And songs, the list went on.
Well, what happened in those 7 years between I Predict 1990 and Squint? I mean, 7 years, were you just hiding in a cave?
Well, I moved to England with my wife for a while, and then the opportunity came up to form a band with some fellow believers, but the goal was, we all kind of felt like there was a glass ceiling built into anything that was labeled Christian music, and so we formed a band called Chagall Guevara. That was probably our first mistake, but anyway, we moved to, two of us were living in L.A. at the time. We moved to Nashville, where the other two guys were living, and we, you know, started writing songs and playing at clubs, and fairly quickly got signed to a label called MCA Records, and it turns out that was our second mistake, that probably wasn't the best label to sign to, but we didn't know any better,
right.
And we made one, I think, quite good album. But the process took a while.
But this is the album that Rolling Stone compared to The Clash. I mean,
you
must have been over the moon comparison.
Honestly, that was probably my favorite moment in a kind of difficult and tortured time. we all were very happy with that Rolling Stone review.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. You know, I remember asking Larry Norman, you keep saying a year ago, but then another year goes by, you keep saying a year ago. It doesn't work, right? I got to do the math here. I facetiously sort of asked him when he would be releasing his worship CD.
Oh, right.
And we had a lovely little discourse about that. What's your take on the whole worship phenomena? You know, what's going on in your head?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in some ways I'm compromised. I've worked with this band, Newsboys, for a while. In fact, I started working with them right around the time that our band, Chagall Guevara, we were trying to get out of our label, and we were stuck. And so in the meantime, a friend of mine asked me if I'd be interested in writing a song with this band, Newsboys. And they were pretty new, and they were, you know, they were from Australia, and I'd heard some of their past albums and wasn't very impressed. But I heard this melody for something called... a song called Not Ashamed, and it said, "I'm not ashamed to speak the name of Jesus Christ." And I really liked that sentiment, and especially, you know, after what I've been through, being in a band on a secular label and, you know, always feeling like we were kind of having to couch things so we didn't get tagged as a Christian band. And that started a collaboration that's gone for a long time. But about 4 years ago, Newsboys decided to do a worship album. And, you know, they wanted me to produce it with them and you know, write the lyrics to the songs like I've done on most of their previous albums. And I said, "Man, I'm sorry. I sing songs in church, but I really don't know anything about worship music as far as how to write those kinds of songs." And, you know, I hope I'm not offending anybody, but most of those songs seem almost illiterate when you compare them to, like, great hymns and, you know, the theology that you find in great hymns in the past. They felt, some of them were very moving, but a lot of them felt very simple-minded to me.
Yeah, it's like Vinnie Barbarino and the Sweat Hogs wrote them.
Right. So, but that's why I'm compromised, is because I ended up doing this record and kind of struggling my way through and trying to help them, you know, create something that seemed good and seemed worshipful without necessarily knowing exactly what I was doing.
Sure.
And so I can't very well completely critique it, because out of that came some songs that now get sung in Sunday morning worship. And so,
well, you changed, boy.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of a sellout.
Are you? Oh, man. Hey, listen, what happened with Sixpence None the Richer?
Well, they're all doing well, and most of them still live in Nashville, but the band is no longer together. They broke up a couple years ago.
Well, one thing I just want to run by here, and this is a bit of an odd thing. I like to do this with our guests once in a while, but it's unfortunate. Most of my goofy stuff is on YouTube, and this is radio.
Right.
So, but I just wanted to just maybe...
At the top of the news, meltdown at Madame Tussauds. Tragedy struck today when workers at the famed London Wax Museum discovered the world-renowned wax figures melting due to high temperatures apparently caused by a faulty thermostat.
The lovely Lisa Welchel from back in the day.
I know where this is going.
Well, there's another guest I had on the show a little while ago, Lisa, and loving her stuff and where she was at. I had Stormy O'Mardian on last week, and Lisa Welchel came up again in the conversation because Stormy had those horrendous exercise videos.
That's right.
Where people wore pink and baby blue and
Lisa... Was Lisa exercising
enough? Oh, yeah.
I forgot that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was fairly disturbing. But this video here, Meltdown at Madame Tussauds.
Yes.
Starring Lisa Welchel. That was your first concept video, I understand.
It was, yeah. Well, I see, when I was at Colorado University, I was studying music, but I had like a minor in film. And so I always wanted to kind of keep one foot in it. Music opportunities came calling first, but when it came time to do a music video, the label said, you know, we really don't have any money for a music video, but we'd love to see a music video for this song. And so they said, you know, if I said, well, I could maybe do it, they said, here's $5,000, go knock yourself out. And so, yeah, that was my first opportunity to kind of put something together and direct it. And I knew Lisa well at the time, and she was very graciously took a break from her Facts of Life duties. And
did you write a song about her? Or,
you know, I actually wrote a. She had a label. She had an album that came out a year later, and she asked if I could write a song, and how could I say no, since she'd so graciously been in the music video. So
Back in the day, there weren't a whole lot of guys saying no to Lisa Welchel. Let me tell you.
So there's a song on her album that I wrote.
Did you and her ever have a little
you know, we went out.
A little.
A few times.
Nudge,
she was
wink,
very,
wink.
Very nice.
Say no more.
Yeah. So no, she's a lovely, lovely person. I haven't talked to her in a while. I think we emailed back a while ago, and she's doing. I think she's living in Texas. Is that right?
Well, she sounds like she's living in Texas.
Is that right?
From the interview,
she was from Texas eventually.
Originally. I think Daddy had a ranch out there or something. You know. Where did you think I was going with that? By the way, did I go where you thought I was going?
Well, when I started the record label, for whatever reason, all the staff members, they found out that I had dated Lisa Welchel, and they just would not let it go. You know, I would find little shots of Lisa and Facts of Life, and they'd slip it under the door, and they'd, you know, post it different places, and they just were relentless.
Right. Well, I was fishing. I didn't know whether there was a real thing there, and I caught a big one. So that's
okay,
it.
There
yeah.
You go.
Hey, these days though, it's all about making movies. And now, listen, pardon my honesty here, Steve, but two things. Every time someone tells me that they're a Christian making movies,
right.
The movies inevitably turn out to be some culturally irrelevant, cinematically awkward, you know, end times we're all going to hell kind of dud.
Right.
And number two, Bruce Willis and the Bacon Brothers haven't exactly impressed me with their secondary vocational choices.
That's right.
So please tell me you're better.
Well, that was a lot of my original concern is, you know, I thought, well, if people are going to look at me the way I look at the Bacon Brothers and Russell Crowe having a band, and I think, you know, Keanu Reeves had a band, then I got a big perception problem.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one of the reasons I really kind of burned all musical bridges behind me, so that they would know I was serious about this. And I'm sure I'll come crawling back in years future. But for now, that's pretty much all I do is work on movies. So
you're finally able to put to use that filmmaking course you enrolled
right.
back in '79 at
that's
Colorado
right.
U.
Yeah. Well, so I mean, that honestly, that had kind of been the idea from back in college. It's just that music opportunities came first, and I thought, well, this is probably better for while I'm young to get involved in music and hopefully have some life experience by the time it's, Lord willing, it's time to make movies. And but I, you know, I kept one foot in and directed a lot of music videos and some documentaries and a couple of longer form pieces to hopefully get ready for whenever the opportunity would come.
And you're a huge movie junkie.
I am, yeah. No, I watch a lot of movies and take the art form very seriously, which doesn't mean that I've mastered the art form by any means, but, you know, at least I knew going into the first one, I was reasonably sure that it was going to be a difficult thing, so I didn't go in with any misconceptions. This was going to be easy.
But you're still a walking anomaly. I mean, I don't know anybody who likes Lord of the Rings and Tootsie.
You know, I mean, they're both like, part of the thing is you're always trying to find, when you make a movie, you're trying to find whatever is appropriate for the story. And Lord of the Rings, it's like, who could have done a better job than Peter Jackson did?
Yeah.
But then Tootsie, like, that's almost like the perfect comedy, you know? So.
Have you ever seen Shake Hands with the Devil?
I have not seen Shake Hands with the Devil, although my wife read the book, and she's told me a lot about it. And I'm really impressed with that guy. And, of course, that leads us to a whole other discussion about Africa, which
we'll touch on that in just a couple of minutes. But I had Senator Romeo Dallaire on the show a little while ago, and we talked about his journey and just the grief and the depression and what he saw and the frustration with his hands being tied and the wimpy UN and just all these issues going on there. And so, of course, there's a documentary out, Shake Hands with the Devil, of him going back for the 10th anniversary.
Right.
But now there's been a motion picture released as well. I haven't seen it really. I was just down in Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket last week, and I was looking through the papers, and I didn't see any release down in that neck of the woods. So, have you heard of it?
No, I didn't know it was a feature.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's.
I'll have to keep an eye out for it.
For sure, for sure. Folks, again, on the phone with the one and only Steve Taylor. Your wife is a painter.
Yes.
And you met how? Was it sort of staring across a crowded room? Your eyes met and.
No, we met at the record label. At the time, I was recording for Sparrow Records. She just happened to be there with a friend who was a recording artist, and her friend had asked her to take the day off work, so because she has a good artistic eye, and her friend wanted Debbie's opinion on some cover shots for an album. So we just happened to meet that day, and this may be more than you want to know, but the publicist at Sparrow, I'd been dating his assistant, and she had recently dropped me. And so the publicist, for whatever reason, felt like it was his job to find
a new replacement.
A new girlfriend. Yes. So when he saw Debbie, he thought, well, she'd be good. So we met.
That's taking the gift of mercy a little too far.
It is. You know, but I'm all eternally in his debt. And then get this. So we met, you know, we shake hands. Nice to meet you. They leave, and he goes running out of the parking lot, to the parking lot with a Meltdown cassette in his hand. And he says, gets her to roll down the window. He says, you know, that guy you just met, well, here's his, here's one of his.
He's kind of a big thing.
Right, right. She'd never heard of me. She'd heard me on the radio, funny enough, but she thought I was Cliff Richard.
So, how did you get that comparison?
I don't know. She heard that song Hero on the radio.
Oh,
so,
man.
So then he comes back in, unbeknownst to me, and he says, Steve, you remember that girl you met 30 minutes ago with Michelle? I said, yeah. He said, she really likes you. She'd like to go out with you. So I guess he thought, well, I'm a publicist. I'm paid to make up things.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was what got things going.
Children, I know a little bit about Sarah.
Yes. We have one daughter, Sarah. And speaking of Africa,
yes.
We had gotten pretty involved with the One Campaign and...
Data?
Yes, and Data. And for, man, that's probably 5 years now, and took a trip to Africa in 2001, and Compassion, we've sponsored a child through Compassion, which is a Christian aid organization.
My listeners know it well.
Oh, fantastic. So, anyway, we got to meet our sponsored child there, and loved the trip so much, and loved Africa so much, and we're so impressed that we ended up sponsoring more kids. Well, in the meantime, I'm doing a lot of work with Data and with the, you know, the crisis in Africa with AIDS, and so Compassion really wanted us, we wanted to go back and see these other kids that we were sponsoring, and they really wanted us to see what they were doing in response to the AIDS crisis. So they took us to an orphanage they just opened in Uganda, and we're hanging around. Of course, we'd done this a number of times before, so this wasn't like a new experience, but for whatever reason, my wife and this little girl just hit it off. So couple days later, and Kenya, my wife, kind of pops the question, what if we, that little girl, Sarah, what if we tried to adopt her? And, you know, I was both shocked and kind of delighted at the thought. So we got home, and it turned out at that point, you know, this is before Angelina Jolie or Madonna, and they just weren't doing international adoptions in mm-hmm. Africa, particularly in Uganda. So, but we met some people, and, you know, we really felt it was God's hand kind of directing things. It turned out that a congressional coalition had just gone to Uganda with the purpose of opening the continent up for international adoption, and we ended up being kind of their test case. So 9 months later, we were in Uganda getting ready to bring our daughter home.
That's tremendous. How old is Sarah now?
She is just turned 11.
And how many years has she been in your family?
For 2.5 years.
2.5 years.
Yeah. She's a really delightful kid. She spoke no English when we first got her, but of course she picked it up really quickly. And,
wow. Good for you. You know, Jeff Moore and I have had a lot of good conversations over a few choice beverages. And, you know, he's done the whole adoption thing. And, of course, through his buddy there with the three names. What's his name? David Clayton Taunton. What's his buddy's name?
Stephen Curtis Savage. That's it.
Can never remember that guy. There seems to be more and more. And Naomi Judd's assistant just recently adopted an international child.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
We had her on the show sharing her journey. It's quite a moving scenario. It really is.
Yeah. Well, it's a great thing to see my fellow Christians so involved in this because, you know, we believe that God has a particular place in his heart for widows and orphans, and the Christian community has really led the way, I think, in international adoption, at least in the United States, and I'm assuming Canada as well. So.
Well, let's talk about a couple of issues just real quickly, kind of like bing, bang, boom.
Uh-huh.
Steve Taylor on the show with us, folks. I was disturbed with the fact that Al Gore won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Uh-huh.
That's disturbing to me.
Right.
My reaction was almost as disturbing. I'm glad no one was anywhere near earshot of me. Global warming, Al Gore. Give me a couple of sentences on that.
You know, again, I'm compromised. I got called up. Get this. I get called up like 4 or 5 months ago. And I don't do these things anyway, but someone said, we need you to film this PSA for with Al Gore. And I said, well, what's it for? And they said, it was just like a birthday greeting for somebody. And so I'm like, well, yeah, why not? So
a public service announcement was a birthday greeting?
Well, the first one was a public service announcement with his wife about literacy. And then the second, and because they liked me, than there if I could film his birthday greeting.
Okay.
So I'm not the person to ask. He lives in my state. I mean, I certainly don't agree with a lot of his politics, but I will say when I was at their house, they had a lot of fluorescent energy-saving bulbs. So, you know, they got that going.
That's your commentary on this?
And he was a very nice guy, so sorry.
Right.
You're going to be really upset with me. I don't have a whole lot.
How do you spell sell out again? How is that spelled? Time article.
I will say this. Yeah. I think Mr. Bono should be being looked at for one of these.
You think?
When I think of a Peace Prize. Yeah, when I think of a Peace Prize, I think of someone who is I think global warming is real. I'm not sure if it's, you know, how big of an issue it is, but I believe it's happening. But it was strange to me that he was picked for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, thanks for that. Time article on Mother Teresa.
I missed that article. I heard about it was. Now this was about her book where she talks about doubts.
Yeah, like not feeling any intimacy with God and doubting his existence many times for much of 50 years.
But I mean, see, doubt is something that we live with as Christians often. You know, that doesn't. I would think Mother Teresa. I didn't read it, but I would think she would say the same thing. Is that, you know, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, and that's the soil where we plant ourselves.
Well, so, doubt is certainly, in my opinion, more compatible with faith than certainty.
That's absolutely right.
Just in my opinion.
Very well put.
George Bush, Republican, Bible wrapped in American flag, Iraq, Afghanistan.
Well, we just get in all kinds of trouble when we directly align our politics and our Christian faith, because Christian faith I appreciate. I've got friends in government. I've got friends who are very active in issues, particularly when it comes to something like pro-life issues. I appreciate that they're on the front lines. But I'm not sure how it happened. But the fact that, you know, the Republican Party and evangelical Christians became synonymous in the eyes of a lot of people has been a disaster, and it's not doing the perception of Christianity any good, and it's you know, we got a lot of people to apologize to.
Yeah, you know, one of the books that has written quite accurately and quite helpfully on this issue has been Tony Campolo's Letters to Young Evangelical.
I haven't read that.
Oh,
although I like Tony a lot.
He has nailed it in this book. Absolutely nailed it. Bono, Africa, AIDS, starvation, data.
Well, I got to say this. Bono had the idea early on. This is like 5 years ago. He felt like the church in America was a great sort of untapped resource. And he really made the decision, I want to speak directly to the church, to my fellow Christians about this issue. And I was one of the people that got recruited early on, and was able to be of some help in that effort. And in the space of 2 years, you know, evangelicals, they did a poll early on that, you know, only 3% of evangelicals would be willing to help someone in Africa with AIDS. And
wow,
that's totally turned around in the space of just a few years. And I think Bono's efforts had a lot to do with it, but what was amazing is I, 2 years later, the New York Times was talking about how the movement of Americans engaged in Africa is now a serious movement, and it's totally because of the Christian Church. So that was a remarkable turnaround, and I think Bono has rightfully gets a lot of the credit.
Rick and Kay Warren have joined us a few times here to talk about things that have gone on through Saddleback and other organizations, and they really have been movers and shakers. They're just not mega church pastors or giga church pastors.
Right. No, I've great admiration for what they're doing, and realizing that, you know, if things are going to change in Africa, it's going to be it's got to be a holistic approach.
Oh yeah, and we do need to mobilize the world's largest untapped resource of volunteers, which is the church.
That's right.
Postmodernity and emerging church. I had dinner with Brian McLaren a couple of weeks ago, and boy, there's a lot of cussing going on in that scene. You know, there's the good old boys like MacArthur, who's always got someone in his scopes, and
right.
happens to be in his latest book, Mr. McLaren.
Right.
What's your take on the only? Because you were like, dude, I just called you dude. You were emerging before emerging was emerging.
Well, I'm a staunch defender of Christian orthodoxy, and I think to the degree that the emergent church, you know, continues to recognize that there is a point where you're not Christian anymore, then I think a lot of what's coming out of that is good. But, you know, I'm always really hesitant to align myself with, certainly I don't align myself with a political party, and so I'm also hesitant to align myself with any kind of, you know, movement, I guess, in some ways.
Wise move.
Thanks. I might as well be running for office. I sound like a politician in every one of these answers.
When you listen back on this, just let me know how it goes. Well, looking back, we're just about done with our time here with Steve Taylor, and certainly have appreciated it very much. Thank you for what you've done and how you've done it over the years, Steve. It's been good.
This has been a lot of fun.
But looking back, is there anything about your theology that you remember, you know, you sort of pushed on people back then, and now you sort of cringe about it?
You know, the one thing that I cringe on is when I was a youth pastor, I just think, I did that for 5 years, and I was reasonably good at it, I would say. I certainly love my kids, but I look at what a lot of youth groups these days are doing, you know, taking trips to Mexico and building houses and taking missions trips. And I just wish I would have done more of that back in the day, you know, then it was like a lot of time. I mean, we'd have serious Bible studies, but there was also a sense of we got to keep these kids entertained, you know.
Right.
And so I still go back to that church often, and it's gratifying to meet kids that were in the youth group that, you know, are now have families of their own and are strong Christian believers. But one of my regrets is not taking more service opportunities with my youth group kids, and it's something I'm trying to make sure doesn't happen as we raise our daughter.
I was speaking with Ian Morgan Cron the other week. He has written a book called Chasing Francis.
Yes, I've read some of that book. That was really fascinating.
Yeah, very, very good read. And, you know, I said to him, you know, you're pastoring in a church in the richest area, in the richest state, in the richest country in the entire world, the entire history of the world. You know, how do you not get chucked out as a pastor by keep coming at them with, you know, give your money, got to give. He said, I find that I don't need to do that. All I do is I take them out to the field. I take them out where they can see into the eyes of the least of these.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah.
And God does the rest.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's certainly been the case with our family.
Thank you. It's been tremendous. You're on holidays with your family. I think I've just disturbed your
family. No, we're fine. We're at the Peabody Hotel where they have ducks in the lobby. So we got to go see the ducks in a few minutes.
Tremendous. And just the song Kiss Me.
Yes.
What did you have to do with that song?
I produced the song.
I thought you did.
Right.
Can I just say, my son and his crowd, his 18, 19-year-old crowd,
right,
they still love that tune.
Oh, that's good.
I tell
hear.
You, no, that thing permeated something fierce. So well done. Another big hit by the one and only Steve Taylor. Thanks, mate, and come back and join us again.
I'll look forward to it, Drew.
Take
Thanks.
Care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Steve Taylor on the Drew Marshall Show. You folks will know this song. Sixpence, none the richer. Kiss Me. When we come back, another guest and more stuff to talk about.
Like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
So kiss me.